Thank you, Becky. We're here for our second presentation from the Capella Fellows on their projects. So you are hopefully looking at Tracy's PowerPoint screen. Becky, you also gave us access to the chalkboard, the Google Shared document that Anthony has done. So if you can watch your screen, think, type, do all those things in a multitask way, great. Add your comments to Tracy, for Tracy. We'll also have some a few minutes after her presentation for those of us who are less adept at multitasking to actually ask some questions or offer some comments. So without further ado, we've got four presenters tonight. We've got about an hour, so I'm going to ask you try to keep your formal presentation down to less than 10 minutes, maybe, you know, 7 or 8 minutes, something like that. That could give us a full 4 or 5 minutes for interaction. Tracy, take it away.
Thank you, Steve. All right, so tonight I will be discussing with you guys my project entitled Patient Safety in the Ambulatory Setting. No news is not always good news. So a little background. My first thing I want to do is actually provide you with a take-home thought to think through my presentation is safety first. Safety is like a lock, but we are all the key. Patient safety was brought to the forefront of public health issues and grabbed to the attention of policymakers with the Institute of Medicine 1999 report, The Air is Human, Building a Safer Health System. But despite that most of patient care taking place is in the outpatient setting, approximately 1.2 billion visits a year, most patient safety endeavors and quality improvement undertakings have been widely on the inpatient side. And mainly that has been because of the high-stakes nature of the inpatient medicine side and also the nature of those errors. And then there's also the nature of the patient-provider relationship, which is far more important, usually viewed on the ambulatory side, as a lot of the patient safety errors, and particularly one study with Gandhi et al., found that 46% of errors involve significant patient factors, with nearly half of those reflecting non-adherence. So it's really important to have a really good patient-provider relationship when you're on the ambulatory side. Thus, historically, there has been few studies dedicated to patient safety in ambulatory care, and in the last few years, there have been a few studies looking at certain aspects of patient safety on the ambulatory side, but not necessarily in general. And then also, ARC has recently started a patient safety initiative as well, and there have been beginnings of funding certain patient safety projects. And another part that's further complicating this issue is, what does patient safety necessarily look like on the outpatient side? Can we take home some of those things we learned with Peter Parnevoet at Hopkins and Michigan study? Can we take home some of those same principles and use those in the ambulatory setting? And before I begin discussing my project, I just wanted to review some of the most widely documented ambulatory errors, and that includes medication errors being number one, diagnostic errors, missed, delayed, wrong diagnosis, lab errors, clinical knowledge errors, communication, and also administrative errors. So the purpose of my project was to call awareness to the importance of patient safety in the ambulatory setting, and to specifically create both practical and measurable ways to promote a cultural of safety in the primary care continuity clinic. And we're doing that through medical education, specifically through lectures, through M&Ms or morbidity and mortality and improvement conferences. The improvement part is really important, not just to sort of beat on the mistakes. And then assessing the culture, current status of patient safety culture at my institution. Also, the purpose of my project was to implement a patient safety reporting mechanism and then measurement of the frequency and type of errors, both pre and post, at the beginning and at the end of the project. So, methods. So, initially, I chart reviewed 138 charts And the domains that I chose, given that I'm in an actual residency clinic and I'm no longer in sort of a faculty practice, I chose preventative medicine, communication to patient of lab results, appointment follow-up, medication errors or refills specifically, and then equipment errors. And as you can see here, how I define each of those domains. In addition, I also conducted a brief presentation on what is patient safety and then the importance of promoting patient safety in the ambulatory setting through the residents, specifically defining what is a medical error, what are near misses, examples of them, how to identify them, and when and how to report them. And then the goal was just to improve the healthcare and safety of our patients in that, and then stress that punitive action would not be taken. And other methods with monitoring was weekly reports. Eventually, I will elicit feedback and survey on each of these of these reporting mechanisms and why have residents or why not have residents chosen to use the tool. And then also I have a monthly morbidity, mortality, and improvement conference, initially the first one to be done by me and then a team of residents I will work with each month in order in putting one together. So the third thing part of our project is I had a survey, pre and post survey. So this would be how residents answered in the beginning. So I adapted this from ARC and some of the domains posted here from the survey. It's a pretty long survey, so I didn't use all of it because I wanted to make sure that the residents filled it out. And it was access to care, patient identification, charts and medical records, and medical equipment. And then another part was medication and diagnostic tests. And then I added my own set of questions at the end, and that were, and my questions were most healthcare for a patient, where does it take place? Is it in the ambulatory setting? Then also ask patients, ask residents, most errors in healthcare occur in the inpatient setting. Then I also ask, what are some examples of patient safety errors that may occur in the ambulatory setting, and what are some challenges to implementing some of those errors and how we can translate that into practice? So I have some very preliminary results. This is figure number one, and it's categories of medical error and frequency of harm. Most of the errors that I examined on chart review were in appointments and follow-up. And I think, and maybe potentially this may have something to do with the level of training, but they were mostly appointments and follow-up, followed by communication at 28%, and then medication errors at 22%. And then here's a table of the frequency of the harm and the actual number of medical error. And so I examined and noticed 56 of them. And then this is a table of examples of some of those errors. One was potentially, I thought was interesting, was just equipment. I never really thought much about that before doing research on this, but just having appropriate and available equipment at the right time. So the institution that I currently work at is pretty huge, and so we had one EKG working one day, and we had a patient with chest pain. Eventually, we had to send him to the ED, but there was only one functioning EKG, and there was not actually only number four. And then also, there was medication. I noticed that sometimes a lot of the problem was residents being able, because they're in different clinics and not at the same place all the time, was following up with patients and lab results. There's one particular example where providers switched to another blood pressure medicine and de-seated in the system but didn't inform the patient. Another delayed diagnosis one. There was one where a patient was reordered the Hep B series when he received it a year ago, and it was actually documented in the chart. Then another interesting one where a patient was reordered potassium. So he went home on potassium while an inpatient just for a few doses, but however got reordered again, had not had labs for months, and had been on potassium while he's on spironolactone. Potassium's burned diuretic and was lisinopril, so when my resident and I saw him in clinic, potassium was 7. and then other preliminary results, the patient safety reporting tool. So initially I wanted to do something online, and I'm still working on that. But in the interim, a few weeks ago, I just implemented a box where residents can put in those, put in any instances of errors and report those anonymously, or they can tell me. So at this point, I've only had four residents that submitted any instances of errors or near misses. But I suspect more when we get more education out there that we'll, and then maybe have something like an online mechanism that would be, it might be more, it would use more. And then the survey, we had 28 responses, and some of the questions I asked were what are some of the common examples of patient safety error that may occur in the ambulatory setting? And then many residents knew about delayed diagnoses, miscommunication on medications, or misdiagnoses. And then several just didn't answer at all. And then what are the challenges to implementation of efforts to translate evidence into practice? And most of the residents answered the culture, technology, and then a lack of staff in place. They thought that not having enough people on their team to help would be difficult for one person to follow up and do all of those things in the ambulatory setting. And also our patient population, which is mostly resource poor, and lots of times we not have steady home environments or ways to communicate with the patients. And then also here in figure two were the survey questions. So I just put it here in sort of a graphical form. Most healthcare for a patient takes care in the ambulatory setting. So most agreed that most of healthcare takes place in the ambulatory setting. However, they thought that most errors took place in the inpatient setting. Most strongly agreed that, which is interesting, but I guess that goes a lot with our training as residents, that we really put inpatient sort of as a priority, which is sort of a flawed thinking over outpatient medicine. So in conclusion, appointment/follow-up, communication, and medication errors were the top three domains where medical errors were examined on my chart review. I think these are the areas that should be prioritized when addressing safety concerns in this particular clinic. It is consistent with prior studies as areas of concern, although most medical errors are often cited. Medication errors are often the most cited. It's a frequent type of error. And improvement in inpatient safety in the ambulatory setting, I think will continue to be a challenge because it's high volume, super busy, often understaffed, and resource poor areas. And that it should be more of a research priority and supported for academic pursuits. And I think each clinic needs their own individualized safety protocol based on their needs and resources, but I think there still are some common areas of deficiencies where solutions could be generalizable. So limitations to the project. So to the project itself, coaching institutions midstream and then just learning new systems and areas of need and key players was a challenge, and it's sort of trying to get used to a different part of the country and finding everyone and trying to contact people in such a small, short of time was a limitation. I had a small sample size. I could only really sample residents during the clinics where I was in. So that was a limitation.
Tracy, in the interest of time, I'm going to ask you to kind of skip over your limitations because we know you're very unlimited. So.
Okay. So next up, basically, I will just continue on with the project and write it up for we have a patient safety research conference at my institution, and I also wanted to send it to SGEM. And still working on that call to action, and I'm either submitting it to KevinMD or post it to the NPA blog. And actually, I've considered applying. I've reached out to ARC, and there are actually some funding for patient safety research, which is kind of different, but they do have some funding for that, and so actually may continue on with this project as funding for my professorship. So in the end, the best way to get a good idea is to get a lot of ideas. There is a right thing to do with regard to quality of care. Improve it if that takes courage, so be it. And I'm Stan Burke. Any questions?
Great, thanks. Questions for Tracy?
Hey, Tracy, it's Sumer. Maybe I missed this. How did you come up with the domains again? Was it basically based off that survey that you used and the predetermined?
Well, from ARC, from ARC, and there was actually this pediatric study that I referenced, and they did a similar study over time at several clinics, and then that's how they came up with those domains. And so I would like to replicate it and make it bigger there at my institution.
Thank you.
Other questions? This is Anthony. I'm curious, did you meet with a lot of support and excitement about this or with resistance from your current clinic?
There was support, but also just sort of actually kind of a lack of or just kind of ambivalence about it. But I met with someone who's really, really into it, but more so on the inpatient side, but thought it was great. And so it took longer to kind of get this going. But really, it was just me doing this. For the most part, I have some incoming interns that I've met recently that are really interested in it. So I think I'll have some more support and hopefully financial support to expand the work.
Hey, Tracy, it's Chris Petrilli. I think it was one of your earlier slides, you talked about an M&M with improvement, which I think is really important. We were talking on our chat board about how M&Ms are great, but a lot of times we just kind of point out problems. We ooh and ah about how terrible a case might have gone, and usually those are more focused on the inpatient side. Are there M&Ms that are outpatient at your site, and are you actively pursuing those M&Ms with improvement strategies, and how are those working if you are?
Yep. So they have done one before there at my site, but not improvement. It was just sort of an M&M. It wasn't an improvement piece. So I've suggested to my team, and it's been the works, but because they plan curriculum so far in advance, I couldn't get directly on the schedule, but they are in agreement that I can do M&M with improvement. I would do the first one, and then each month I work with a set of residents after I identify a case, and they will do one each month for one of their new conferences. But currently they are not doing one with that sort of strategy, with improvement.
Because that way, I feel like that would be great, and I feel like otherwise they're just kind of fun and not really kind of useful.
Right.
But otherwise, people are just always talking about problems and that. So if you can get that started, I think that would be a huge benefit.
Right. I think, again, most of our time inpatient, it's really hard to really get our grasp on some outpatient things and how it works and workflow and communication and teams. So having that solution piece, I think, is important.
I'm gonna take the moderator's prerogative and have my comment be the last one, or my question be the last one, so we can move on. But Tracy, if you had a magic wand and you could do one and only one thing to improve safety in the outpatient arena, what would it be?
I think communication, because everything goes back to communication. They had the medication error because of communication. I think communication is the biggest piece.
Great. Perfect. Okay, thanks so much. I really, really appreciate that. That's a wonderful beginning. I certainly can respond to that every day. I think I must make a million errors. All right, well, we'll move on to Winfred, who's going to be talking to us about prescribing buprenorphine in a family medicine residency outpatient clinic. Winfred?
Yeah, is my screen – can you guys see my screen?
Not yet.
I can, but not through start meeting.
Okay. Because it says I have to – whoa, there's a lot going on here. all right, so you guys cannot see this.
Yeah, Winfred, can I give a one-minute primer on buprenorphine while you try to get your screen going? Is that okay, Steve? So for those who are unaware, buprenorphine is a mu opioid receptor partial agonist, and it's prescribed in an office-based setting as a method of treating opioid use disorder, and generally speaking, it does very well with that.
Okay, Winfred, I think we're ready to go.
Okay, great. So I'm Winfred Fraser. Awesome. So I'm Winfred Fraser. I'm a family medicine physician in Pittsburgh, among a bunch of other things. And I'll be talking about initiation of buprenorphine prescribing in a family medicine residency clinic. All right, so just to give you guys some background, if you haven't heard, there's a big opioid epidemic in the country. You probably know this at this point. And specifically looking at southwestern Pennsylvania, where I live, Allegheny County, where Pittsburgh is the county seat, you can see that in 2015, there are 326 deaths due to opioids, drug-related. So not just in actual the city is the issue, but also you can see the surrounding counties. Butler, Westmoreland, Washington County also had a fair number of overdose deaths. But you can see the percent change from 2014. It's pretty alarming. I mean, Allegheny County had 6.2%, but, you know, Washington County, 78.4% increase just from a year. Westmoreland County, 28%, you know, it's huge. So clearly, opioids are a problem. Deaths are a problem. This is a national problem. This is also a regional problem where I live in my community. So that's kind of where I wanted my project to focus on. So specifically, the clinic I'm looking at is in New Kensington, which is just outside of Pittsburgh. It's where the Star is. So it's kind of a smaller smaller community clinic in a medically underserved area just outside of the city. And just from our clinic population, in 2015, we had 5 patients who had fatal overdoses due to opioids. So at that point, me and the medical director of the clinic were just like, you know, we need to do something. This is a huge problem. Nothing's really being done. It's just really time to kind of get this started. So there's a huge need for our patient population. So not only in an outpatient setting, but a lot of our patients from that clinic were being admitted to the hospital for non-fatal overdose. So that was kind of where we figured out, you know, this is the need for this project to initiate buprenorphine. Sorry, just having technical difficulties. Okay. So this is my project. I kind of already talked about it. I'll go through several steps that we have gone through, and we're still kind of going through the steps. So number one, kind of doing a needs assessment. I mean, it was pretty easy because I think it's clear all over the country, whether you're in a rural area, suburban area, or urban area, that there's need for treatment, especially in rural areas where we know that there's a lack of addiction treatment, there's a lack of counseling, psychological services for these patients. But just kind of doing a brief chart review of some of the patients who had overdose deaths and kind of looking at the history and looking at what services that they had done, we noticed that this was a problem. The second issue, so to prescribe buprenorphine, you have to have a waiver. And so this waiver involves doing an 8-hour training online, looking at some slides, taking a pretty easy test, and that's all you need to prescribe buprenorphine. So it's pretty straightforward to do. And so far we have 2 physicians with the third getting waivered. All right, so second step is stakeholder buy-in. So you think that everyone would be enthusiastic about prescribing buprenorphine to helping people who have addiction issues, but that's not really the case. You know, we have a lot of faculty within our program who are just like, you know, I don't really want to do this. I'm not really interested. I don't think it's going to help. It's a waste of your time. We also have staff, you know, just like a lot of places, we have a lot of staff shortages, and the staff is like, you know, we're already short-staffed. Like, how are we going to support this? In addition, I don't want these disheveled drug addicts in my waiting room. Like, no, I don't want that. Even though the kind of studies have shown that that's not really the case. But barriers like that, and it's, I mean, you know, we want our staff to be happy. We want them to work with us, so it's kind of important. Also, stakeholders, and this chat is so distracting in a funny way. But also, you know, just seeing what's in the community.
Winford, yeah. I'm glad you said that because it's driving me nuts. So I would hope that people can limit their chatting because it's appearing on the PowerPoint slides and it's very distracting. Please continue.
And I was contributing to that, so I apologize as well. So anyway, so stakeholder buy-in, see what other treatment centers in the area to see if we can partner, work together. Pennsylvania is implementing this kind of hub and spoke model. It's called Suboxone Right. I mean, they might change the name, but basically they have a big addiction center, and that's the hub. And then spokes are kind of satellite clinics where if they have kind of treatment failures or consults, they can go to the big addiction center. So then we did site visits. I mean, there are a number of addiction treatment centers in the area, so we did a number of site visits. There's tons of protocols. Initially, we thought, you know, we really have to get our protocol set before we start this. But kind of talking to other people, they were like, you know, you'll figure this out. You're going to start slow. You're not going to automatically start prescribing buprenorphine to hundreds of patients. You're going to start one patient at a time. So you can kind of build your protocol as you go because every clinic is individualized and different. So the next step is funding. And these steps are not to scale. And this is definitely like the biggest step that we've been trying to cross, and I'll talk a little bit more about funding in a minute, but basically we're looking for a full-time case manager who has addiction expertise to kind of help us. So then, you know, hire staff. You know, this is a training program, and so we really want residents to be able to kind of learn how to prescribe buprenorphine because this problem isn't going away anytime soon. So be able to train our future family medicine physicians to be able to do this is important to us. And then, obviously, the final step, start prescribing. All right, so funding. So we looked at more than two options, but I'm just going to tell you about two options. The first one is we contacted the major health plan, which is UPMC, University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. And so we kind of talked to them, and we were like, you know, it'd be really great if you guys gave us funding to have a full-time case manager. And they said, we're not going to do that. We're going to give you, like, a fourth part-time person until you kind of ramp up and have more patients. And we were like, okay, we'll get back to you. And so the second option that we looked at was this Stem Farm Foundation grant. And so we applied for this grant, which would be for two full-time positions for 2 years because we really want someone to start full-time, really be integrated into our clinic from the beginning. So we have a site visit August 11th. We're really excited. We have a good relationship with this foundation before, and they provided grants for our clinic in the past, so hopefully we'll get that. But this is kind of the biggest barrier that we're waiting on is funding because in order to do this right, we really need a case manager who ideally has addiction kind of expertise. And so future directions. Once we kind of cross the three steps, I have another year left, so hopefully we'll get this done the next year. But we want to do some, like, quality improvement projects. We want to look at, like, quantitative overdose outcomes. We want to look at hospitalization admissions, kind of based on what we're doing. And then qualitative, obviously, to kind of see what staff, physicians, and patients, kind of what their attitudes are towards buprenorphine prescribing. There's been a number of qualitative studies looking at this, but kind of looking at it in our patient population would be important. So that's kind of my final slide. I'd like to thank a bunch of people here, including NPA staff. You guys have been great, and co-fellows for giving me feedback. I really appreciate it. And hopefully we can kind of get across this funding hurdle and start prescribing for our patients who really need it. Thank you.
Great, Winfred. I appreciate your brevity as well. So questions for Winfred, please.
Hey, Winfred. It's Sumer. It seems that the funding is definitely a big issue here. I was talking to one of the partners at Apple Tree Ventures, the folks that funded the implantable buprenorphine. And I just think it's really interesting because this problem is so massive and of national scale for you to consider, not now, but in the future, if you can prove this pilot, thinking about looking outside of academia to see if you can solve this problem using private money, if you can find the right forward-thinking progressive partner in the VC world that's interested in tackling this problem, because I think there's a lot to be said for doing things that way, even though it's not conventionally thought of. So just something that I throw out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We're looking at all types of funding options at this point. So if we don't get this grant, then we'll definitely kind of look at other options for sure.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you for writing on the chalkboard too. Okay. Well, thank you, Winthrop. Was there somebody else want to say something?
So Anthony, just a very quick comment. Winfred, a very exciting mission training resident because you get people early in their training and that informs the rest of the practice. Thank you for that.
Yeah, no problem.
Yes, I think it's tremendously important. I think everywhere in the country we're seeing the same kinds of problems. Please go ahead, those folks who want to add more things to the chalkboard in terms of feedback from Winfred, and I commend you for the project. Next is Jonathan, and it's Transforming Care at the Greater Lawrence Health Center, empowering those who need it the most. Jonathan. Hello, Jonathan.
If you see your slides, you may need to press *6 to unmute your line.
A night of technical gremlins.
I see in the chat window that he's going to dial back in.
Oh, okay.
Jonathan? Oh, I think that was him leaving.
Well, while we're waiting for Jonathan to come back in, does anybody have any other questions that they've thought of for Tracy or for Winfred?
Well, I guess one of the questions I have, Winfred, because we have a clinic as well, is how did you go about reassuring Jonathan, there?
I'm back. Can you hear me?
Oh, okay, John. Now we can hear you.
Wonderful, okay. Wonderful. All right, yeah, I couldn't unmute myself for some reason. So, I'm going to share a few slides and our progress so far in our efforts to really target the patients that need the most care at our health center up just outside of Boston. And share with you, what we've been able to accomplish and then some of our setbacks and where we hope to go, going forward. So the project is really born out of, a frustration with sort of how we provide care right now is that we have a large population of patients, at our clinic, we serve over 50,000, almost 60,000 patients now, and we understand that, they have a variety of medical, social, and mental factors that influence their health and well-being. And as the PCP, as a primary care provider, we'd like to think we are sort of first and foremost in that patient, navigating them through those factors that affect their health. But in reality, we're just one of many different influences on their health. And really, none of this is coordinated in any strategic way. And so our vision really is to try and, through the use of care management and a long-term trusting relationship with the primary care provider, grounded in the medical home of our health center, try and help coordinate that care so that way the patient can help sort of navigate this crazy system of healthcare a bit better and that can be targeted specifically to the patients that need it when they need it. And so we really want to focus on the patients of the super utilizers. Some of the definitions can vary in the literature. Most commonly, it's 2 admissions or more in the previous 6 months. Based on our data, we looked at the top 10% of patients would get, say, 4 admissions within 1 calendar year, with like a max of 12 to 13, at least at the one hospital that we were able to get records from. And so our base work, you know, baseline theory is that, you know, the sort of balance between medical, social, and mental health is offset in some way, leading to a moment of crisis. And for these patients, there's sort of only, you know, output really is to go to the ED because it, you know, they're normally pretty sick at baseline. They get hospitalized pretty easily. And then they get discharged back into the same cycle. And so we really wanted to break this cycle by creating a multidisciplinary team to improve their health and decrease their admissions by addressing, you know, these multi-sectoral needs. And so our idea was to create this team with these different members that currently all exist in a health center except the community health worker, which would be a new position, really to leverage everyone's different skills, and so that way we could all be on the same page in caring for these patients. And the idea is that the patient would be admitted, say, for the 4th time in that 1 year, and then that would sort of start our intervention. There's decent evidence for a variety of interventions starting at time of discharge, given the nationwide interest in reducing readmissions. And so coming up with a coordinated discharge plan, a lot of them tend to be very sort of nursing and, like, medical care-centric. The work that Camden Coalition and, like, Jeffrey Brenner have done is much more, you know, patient-centric, trying to navigate both of those worlds. And our clinic, one of the issues is that we do a pretty good job of actually getting patients follow-up from discharge within, say, a week of leaving the hospital. But because our doctors' schedules are pretty overbooked, they typically see a nurse practitioner, and they may or may not get a discharge summary. And then depending on if the patient was cared for by the resident team or by the hospitalist, the med rec can be anywhere from, you know, pretty much accurate to being completely inaccurate. And then the patient leaves the hospital. And right now, especially for patients that are coming to the hospital frequently, the hospital has sort of taken it among themselves to start their own outreach projects. They've gotten a couple of grants from MassHealth, the Medicaid organization from Massachusetts. And so they'll have, like, a social worker, they'll have a transition coach sort of reach out to some of these patients, but with no coordination whatsoever with the primary care doctor or with our organization, Great Alliance in general. The hospital and us as the health center are affiliated, and so I do have my training in both places, but from a care delivery standpoint, they're sort of pretty separate. We have completely separate EMRs and all of that kind of stuff. The one nice thing, though, is that we do have full access to the EMRs in the hospital because we use them when we're inpatient. And so the idea was after we sort of helped streamline the outreach to the patients and they would present to what we're initially calling our super utilizer clinic. And here, really, this would be a once-a-week clinic to start, and it would be an opportunity to provide enhanced care coordination, help address any social services they need, get everyone on the same page about what medications they're on, and also integrate behavioral health into their care, which would probably, for this population, be universally needed. There are a variety of different models out there. Most models typically sort of operate as a standalone clinic whereby the patient, you know, sort of says goodbye to their PCP and then establishes a new PCP as part of the clinic. But given that every one of our patients will have at least an assigned primary care provider, we want to focus on strengthening that original patient PCP relationship and act as more of a consult service for 1 or 2 visits, maybe 3, and then ideally have that patient transition pretty quickly back into the primary care setting. The sort of star of this team and the new sort of innovation for our health clinic would be to hire a community health worker. The continuity is an essential part of this model in providing care for these patients. A lot of our providers are not, our doctors are not one full time, they're sort of part time. And so this person could help navigate inconsistency in care, and then also just be a resource for the patient in the home if they need to go, you know, fill out WIC or go, you know, grocery shopping, that this person could really serve in that role. And so this is just sort of a schematic of, like, how we foresee potentially the clinic and then also community health worker help, you know, not absolving the risk, but decreasing the instances of crises. And then even in that moment of crisis, maybe they can call the community health worker instead of just going to the ED. And the community health worker can help triage the situation, either call a nurse or call a doctor to see if we can do something more immediately. And so we've been working on this for a good year now. And in January, like December, we were able to confirm faculty preceptor support. He's going to donate his faculty development time to support our clinic and staff our clinic as the faculty preceptor. Our health center consists of 5 different sites, and we presented this project to the medical site directors who gave us feedback on sort of where to go next. We then presented to our chief medical officer and program director and got approval from both of them. And then in April, we presented our new CEO, who loved the idea, signed off on hiring the community health worker, and was really seemingly very excited. And so then things sort of went off the deep end a little bit and off the cliff, so to speak. And so we sort of got stuck in the morass of turf wars between nursing and social services, which are 2 separate departments. And no one could really agree on who was going to hire the community health worker and whose department they were going to live in. By July, they're doing the budget for next year. And so there's a full-on hiring freeze currently. And so we found out like 2 or 3 weeks ago that we're not going to be getting a community health worker for this project, which is like sort of like the keystone in the door, so to speak. And so in terms of challenges, I think this is one of the big challenges. I think, you know, step by step, we had gotten approval and everyone said yes. And like, not even just said yes, it was sort of like, yes, these are the next steps, and sort of took the next step. And then after, you know, a month or two, we had to go sort of go back to ground zero. So I mentioned the community health worker. The faculty preceptor, who all along we had always been like saying Tuesday afternoon is the clinic, that's when his we had structured it around his time. And then like a month ago we found out that nope, they need help precepting, and so he's going to go precept other residents in clinic, and he would not be available, which is problematic because our schedules as residents are planned out like a year in advance essentially. The day-to-day is planned out right now 6 months in advance. And so, you know, it's been a struggle all along being like, what do you guys want? And then we'd be like, well, we're not really sure because we haven't started anything. We don't know what we need. And, you know, we did what we could, but now we're sort of stuck because our schedules are free for Tuesday afternoons, but the faculty members is not. And then the other thing was, in terms of financing this, we were going to, we pitched to take money from the new global payment program that MassHealth had been piloting for 20% of our patients, whereby we get a lump sum per month, and which is really designed to like sort of do this kind of you know, change the delivery model. And now MassHealth is going to scrap that program at the end of 2016, and they're currently waiting on a new waiver with the federal government. So we don't really know what that's going to look like. I imagine we're going to still have some sort of global payment structure in the future, but we can't say definitively what it is. And then finally, one of the biggest challenges, too, is just I became chief resident in April 1st, and so balancing sort of all of these things has been an issue. But we're not deterred, and so when I go back from living in the dreamland that is Iora Health, and I go back to residency, we're going to meet with our current team And so right now we have a resident, we have a definitively a behavioralist and clinical pharmacist who have all signed up, and we have tentative agreements from a medical assistant and nurse. And we're going to sort of go back to the drawing board, and instead of probably, I think we're going to scrap the clinic idea to start and sort of maybe, I think, start a bit more narrowly and say, you know, okay, we have all, there's like 15 problems on this list. Let's pick one we want to solve in the next 2 months as a team and then go from there. And I think really sort of establish the leverage that, like, hey, as this team, we can do this. And but we're still sort of restricted with some of the resources, and you know, create some leverage to, you know, in a few months be able to potentially hire a community health worker and get more time for staffing for nurses and all that, or for faculty and everything. So, but thank you too to Becky for all the guidance and advice throughout this process, and Stephen as well, and all of you, and you know, I sort of wish I had some better news in July of 2016, but we're still going to go strong. I've got 2 years left of residency, so we still have time.
Well, great, Jonathan. As they will say, you know, carpe diem. Don't get discouraged. And I think the modifications you're making in the midst of this are appropriate ones. Comments from other people? I think that the funding issue is always a really difficult one. I know here in our local town, we're trying to get community health workers incorporated into the hospital's community benefit plan as part of a community health needs assessment. I really totally agree with you, Jonathan. I think that is the key. If we can get some folks who can really work with the patients in the community, who know the community, this could really make a major impact on hospitalizations.
Thanks. Yep.
Okay, I see people writing on the chalkboard. Thank you very much. Given the time, I'm going to go ahead and go over to our last presentation, which is by Chris. Take it away, Chris.
Great. All right. All right. Can everyone see my screen? I was just about to place a donation. Let me just finish this up. Just kidding.
Great.
Hold on 1 second. All right. My presentation is more of a focus on kind of a recap of what I've been working on for the past year and a half or so, but more specifically what I've done because of NPA and my relationship building with Anthony Accursio, who's unfortunately leaving the Providers for Responsible Ordering chapter to go on to bigger and better things in New York City. But the title of our project was initially Stop It, and the IT stood for Inappropriate Testing. And as an homage to Anthony's mentor, or not mentor, but maybe colleague, Lenny Feldman, who writes a column in the Journal for Hospital Medicine of Things We Do for No Reason, I titled this Things We Do for a Great Reason. Actually, can you guys see that minimized box on your screen or no?
I don't think so.
No. Okay, good. Okay, great. All right. So basically, everyone knows this equation, or if you don't, I'm sure you will see it a billion times. Usually this equation is presented as value equals quality over cost, and people sometimes put in the variation of value equals appropriateness times quality over cost. And what this basically means is value in healthcare is equal to the appropriate type of care times the quality of care delivered divided by the cost of that care. And sometimes we overlook the potential revenue. And while this isn't exactly the focus of my project, I just wanted to touch base on a quick side point kind of project that we've been working on to kind of help our CFO kind of fund us a little bit better. So on doctoring, so everyone knows the first do no harm. Our coding and documentation team added the then document appropriately. And we added this initial solution in MyChart, or we call it MyChart Epic. And basically at the end of every note, you get this table that presents. So you basically, you can F2 through the most common, it's the most commonly missed and the most common major comorbidities that can add to billing. And the reason why billing is important is not just for the monetary purpose, but it's also for reporting for how sick your patients actually are. So whatever research you're going to do or whatever project you end up undertaking, if you're going to see if there's any actual efficacy in whatever intervention you undertook, then you want to actually make sure that you're looking at the same patient population. And a lot of times with this new, with these new electronic health records, it's very difficult to kind of chart review very specific comorbidities that actually impact what Medicare and Medicaid consider to be a significant comorbidity. So these 10, well, there are 9 here, but it, there's, I'll show you on this next slide here. There's, in MyChart or Epic, we built one for every different specialty. And basically you can just, on discharge, you can click through the comorbidities and it'll give you the pertinent lab values at the top. So if a nutrition consult was given, you can see it'll tell you severe protein calorie malnutrition, and those 4 words can sometimes add up to 4 times the amount of revenue to a reimbursement. And while people say, well, this is not about the money, that's true, but that revenue is what keeps the lights on, is what allows your CFO to kind of fund additional projects to help your patients in these additional quality improvement projects that we always seek grant funding for, but we can probably pay for it eventually with our operation budget. So what we saw once we implemented just that simple table at the end, so you can see, so this red line here is the U.S. News and World Report expected mortality, and this blue line is our expected mortality, meaning how sick our based on our documentation, our patients are expected to be. And this dotted pink line is our observed to expected mortality ratio. And you can see the star is when this table was enacted. And you can see that there was a huge drop-off, and that was sustained for 5 quarters. And then on the table on the right, you can see there's a number of charges with major extreme severity of illness or pre-existing conditions also took off. And again, this has nothing really to do with patient care, but you do need to keep the lights on in your hospital. You do need to be able to fund additional projects, so this is very important. The purpose of our project, however, was to stop inappropriate testing. So what we had, in order to get people, so if finance doesn't strike the right chord for you, then articles by Chris Moriades and Tanner Caverly in the Journal of sometimes what, I'm not sure if anyone's familiar with this, but what it does is it gives a quick vignette about how overuse has led to harm to patients. And basically, so it's a vignette. So, for instance, about perioperative testing prior to hernia repair for chest X-ray, I think was the first one that led to an incidental nodule, which led to a CT scan, which led to an incidental loma on an adrenal gland, which led to biopsy. which led to a benign finding. But meanwhile, this patient was in pain for 6 months, and a surgery was delayed because of an inappropriate chest X-ray. So while our institution has their own quality and innovation program, we started our own bottom-up approach, which we called Stop It or Inappropriate Testing, which is essentially a multidisciplinary campaign with the mission to reduce unnecessary testing, and primarily through the electronic health record. So basically every solution that we come up with has to do with the electronic health record, and it must fit into the provider's current workflow. It cannot just involve alerts. And why is this important? Because there are things like Choosing Wisely, which I know started with the NPA. There are things like Caring Wisely at UCSF and articles like Things We Do for No Reason. However, education has been proven to be helpful in the very beginning. You can see these huge spikes in improvement, but they're not very sustainable. And there was actually a report in JAMA Internal Medicine in 2015 which showed that since Choosing Wisely was started, how many of these low-value services actually changed through a major insurance provider. And you could see none. There was no difference since Choosing Wisely came out between the utilization of these seven services that of no value. However, there was another article where they implemented a solution using telemetry where they actually changed the health record rings such that you had to choose a specific indication. And what did you see? You see an immediate and drastic change in the decrease in telemetry utilization that's sustained. And they also reported most recently that that change remained sustained through 2015. And our solution is not to be novel, but to adopt and adapt. So we have a VA solution, which we basically took the guidelines from the American Heart Association and adapted that into a similar solution that was published in JAMA Internal Medicine. We also published a EPIC version of the same one that was published by Dressler, and their version was actually a Cerner solution. And what we saw was a very similar, so the number of admitted patients monitored continuously from admission to discharge, which was previously 100% at our institution, dropped to 55%. The number of admissions monitored continuously on tele from admission to discharge with a length of stay greater than 2 days dropped to 44%. So these are huge improvements that would very unlikely to be seen by interventions like pocket cards that are most likely, they're usually thrown out by a lot of people who come up with types of solutions. So how does this process work? So it's not just telemetry, but we basically come up with anecdotal observation through the literature review. We come up with a story about how someone was injured through either telemetry or whatever target you plan on attacking, like carotid artery ultrasound. For syncope, maybe you do the carotid artery, maybe you see mild stenosis, they end up getting a stent, and then a complication from that carotid artery stent. And then that basically an anecdote is reviewed by a core team, which is comprised of people from nursing, hospitalist group, finance, specialty groups, a project manager who basically keeps us on track, an EPIC physician builder, and at the center, everyone's focused on how do we eliminate these inappropriate tests. Then we look at the utilization data to make sure that it's big enough of a problem to start tackling. We identify supporting faculty to say, yes, this is a problem, and we should tackle this, and I will be supportive because they're going to consult me anyway to order this test, and I'm going to say, no, that should not be ordered. We perform a root cause analysis for why is this test being ordered inappropriately. Is it just because you heard about it in medical school and just something that was ingrained, and like thrombophilia? Someone comes in with a DVT, you order a factor V Leiden, even though it will have no impact on your treatment plan for this patient. And then you identify the specific electronic health record target, you implement an intervention and education plan, and then we undergo the iterative PDCA cycles. So long-term strategies, low-hanging fruit, like inappropriate telemetry, basically things that are already published and proven, that's what we want to target first. And then other things that we know are completely inappropriate, like in an inpatient thrombophilia that is not going to change management, do not start that as an inpatient. Either defer that to outpatient hematology or don't even consider doing that ever. And then phase two and three are more these gray area targets or these top-down approaches where you look at a more global provider variability of utilization. So far we have one full manuscript in the Journal of Hospital Medicine. We published in their series Things We Do for No Reason, Inpatient Thrombophilia Workup, which was accepted in May of this year and awaiting to be published in the actual journal, but it was accepted. And then we presented our VA telemetry solution, our pilot data at SHM 2016, and our coding and documentation solution at SHM 2016. And our active order sets, we want to minimize also the use of PICs, the inappropriate echoes and stat ordering of echoes, which we already have an electronic health record solution designed. We're implementing our electronic health record solution of our inappropriate thrombophilia workup. We're basically just eliminating inpatient factor V Leiden and prothrombin 20210, along with a few other inherited thrombophilia workup. You can order those as an outpatient, but just not as an inpatient when you have a diagnosis of a acute a clot. Like Chris Moriades first published, we're trying to replace nebulizers for meter dose inhalers, reducing daily labs, which actually became a institutional priority. So what started off as with resident leads, where I was the chief resident last year, passed it off to another senior resident this year. Now we just came out of a meeting yesterday where the head of pathology, the head of the chemistry lab, the head of point of care lab, and the head of and one of the chief not the chief financial officer, but the one of the vice president of operations for the pathology department were all in a meeting listening to our resident present the findings that we had for our daily lab data that we had gathered. So it was actually really fascinating. We're also starting a new perioperative testing clinic, trying to reduce perioperative testing and cardiology consults. And we partnered with Blue Cross and Blue Shield to reduce vitamin D testing as well. And then we're also trying to get involved in a new value-based curriculum. And we realized we have to think global and act local. And we realized that to do really well, get teaching time, and those who want to make a big impact, do it tandem style. Hashtag Supple, August 2016, which I think is when he's presenting his tandem app. And it's going to make medical apps great again. The final words, I suggest everyone to take the pledge at providersforresponsibleordering.org. Right now we have 11 sites set up. Unfortunately, Anthony is leaving us, but if anyone is interested in setting up a Providers for Responsible Ordering site, again, the site is providersforresponsibleordering.org. Just go there, express your interest. And his previous resident director, Sonali, I'm not going to try to pronounce the last name, my apologies, will be the new national lead for this, and she's phenomenal. And so just contact her, and she will be able to set up your chapter. So Anthony will be leaving us. Hopefully he'll be able to set up a chapter in New York for us, but it has been a real pleasure working with him over the past year. And his insights and just being able to bounce some ideas off of him has been greatly valued. So if I got one thing that I can truly take with me forever through this National Physician Alliance Fellowship is my relationship with Anthony. So, Anthony, if you're still on the call, I really appreciate getting to know you this past year. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris. That was great. Anthony, you're still on the call, I'm sure. I'll give you the floor to make any comments.
Yeah, Chris, well, first of all, thank you. I did not see that shout-out coming, so thank you very much. And really, honestly, the pleasure is in all mine as well, working with everybody, including Chris. I think one thing that's been very exciting is Chris immediately latched on to the same vision of providers responsible ordering that that we had initially, and so has turned Michigan into this powerhouse of Stop It initiative. And I think it's just very exciting, you know. I immediately had a reaction and a question for Chris. I know I'm aware of the time, but just briefly. So you've had incredible success modifying your electronic medical record, and I'm curious how have you had such success in the digital realm? And just on the quiet flip side of the coin, have you encountered any problems with alert fatigue among your physicians?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So I think the reason why I had such great success was I actually just spent the 2 weeks at Wisconsin, at the Verona, Wisconsin Epic headquarters. So again, this only applies to those institutions that have an Epic system. But if you become a physician builder, which is actually only 3.5 days times two. So 7 days total, but you have to do it separately over 2 weeks, and there's a test in the middle of each one. But once you get through each of those and then complete a project at the end, you get full access to the – you can create whatever order set you would like. So basically in your spare time, you can start creating solutions to whatever you want. So you don't need to wait and put in a ticket for an Epic ticket to into this kind of black hole, hoping someone hears your call for how to make changes to the cardiac monitoring order. You can kind of make those changes while and then present them to leadership and say, listen, here's the changes I'm proposing. I've already made them. I just need to click this button that says update, and it'll be good to go. So it really puts a lot of it really takes a lot of onus off the leadership, so that all they have to do is say, this is a great idea, let's try it, as opposed to them thinking that they need to pour a lot of resources from their IT teams into helping you. So if you could either have yourself, or even I did it when I was a resident, have a resident that's interested go to Verona for maybe one of their research blocks, then I think that's extremely helpful. And it really opens up a lot of doors and makes everything much, much easier down the road.
Right.
And then in terms of alert fatigue, and then I'll be really quick. In terms of alert fatigue, I don't allow alerts in any solution. So you cannot have a solution in any of our pro chapter projects that has an alert. That's one of the things. It has to be built in. So for the thrombophilia, you either eliminate the order, or when you're ordering, when you place the order for, let's say it's a protein S activity, you just have to click a button in the order that says, I attest that this patient does not have an acute VTE. And then you just say yes or no. And then if you say yes, it says it'll cancel the order for you. You don't even have to think about it. So there's no alerts that pop up.
The physician nudge.
Right. Exactly.
Thank you so much, Chris. Given it's almost 10:15, I think we're going to wrap up. I think the takeaway message is, you know, that education alone, knowledge alone doesn't do the work. So we have a lot more work to do besides making people aware of things that we shouldn't be doing. Well, I want to thank everybody for hanging in there. Each of the presentations was, I think, fantastic. I give great congratulations to our four presenters tonight, and urge them to continue doing this great work and move onward. And unless anyone else has something that must be said right now, I'll give you 2 seconds to
say so?
This is Becky. Just real quick, you have August off. We are not planning a call during August, but we'll be in touch with you for a September wrap-up call, and then I'll be in touch with you individually about what we're going to figure out doing with these presentations. Great job, everybody,
is,
tonight.
When is Aaron Stuppel presenting?
It will be in September. The third Wednesday in September, which I think is the 21st.
Great.
But, yeah, we'll get that out.
I'll put it on my calendar.
Thank you.
Great.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody.
Good night, everyone.
And good night.
Congratulations, everybody. Thank you. Thank you.